reading is from Richard Rose's Allergen Papers, the fifth paper, Obstacles to Transcendental Efforts. First section, Argument for Transcendental Research. Transcendentalism not only provokes more negative argument than positive argument, but it also provokes more ridicule. The ridicule is inspired by the comic or pathetic appearance of some transcendental poseurs, fanatics, and psychic ripple makers who make up some of the motley classes of transcendental effort. We can never be sure, except in certain individual cases, whether occultism and transcendentalism causes or worsens the mental conditions which are likely to be described as sick or crazy. And it may be true that some sincere people may have submitted themselves to deprivations, asceticism, or some painful experimentation which may have left them in worse shape than they were before they became transcendentalists. In any event, we should not criticize this latter group until we have walked a mile in their moccasins. As for argument, it is not hard to find arguments against spiritual or transcendental prospecting. The arguments come in from all sides, and especially from those well-organized groups whose concepts might be jeopardized. Religion is content to bed down with the politician and sociologist and make any sort of compromise to protect its slumber. Religion evidently wants no amateurs adding to its enlightenment. Psychology is alarmed by various transcendental findings which might upset the entire psychological pretense. We can dispense with the arguments from religious sources because we should know by now that transcendentalism is actually religious research, and most of the criticism from religion is recognizable as sectarian or political, meaning that some sects embody in their religious practices things which other sects persecute. That which diverts more minds from psychic research than anything else is the persistent scientific sophistry of pseudo-scientific writers. It might be said that material scientists and those esoteric groups which specialize in mind science or systems aimed at states of being are the most polarized. The material scientist claims that the transcendentalist cannot prove anything and implies that the latter makes no sense. The transcendentalist, on the other hand, often does not try to make sense because he feels his development to be superior to logical processes. And he, in turn, also accuses the material scientist of being only a sort of animated slide rule without the necessary feeling ability to actually do research work in dimensions other than the apparent one. However, both work from the same base. Neither denies the existence of man, and their sciences or metasciences are the results of and concerns for understanding man's relation to environment, whether that environment be the visible world, the invisible and molecular man, or the still more invisible and seemingly remote God spark of which molecular man may only be a reflection. We must abridge all such argument and admit that man is a fact, and in being a fact, immediately is assured of the immortality and indestructibility of the fact state. Whatever his limits are as regards his immortality or mortality, or as regards his degree of consciousness, his fact status is permanent. Of course, the concept of the nature of or the exactness of that fact state is interpreted differently by the two polarized groups, and therein lies the root of the misunderstanding. Man is a physical fact in that he, particularly the material scientist, recognizes as man only that man being or man object which is witnessable by the physical senses. And it is true that man is such a fact for such an observer. However, the transcendentalist may go as far as to say that the physical body and the senses themselves are both illusions and the results of illusions. Yet the transcendentalist, as in the case of a Zen student or aspirant to Satori, still views man as a fact. The amazing thing is that this latter group of transcendentalists views their concept of man's fact status as more concrete and real than any other. Their fact man is indestructible and complete. The fact man of the material scientists is a transitory creature and a limited one. Another argument against transcendental work consists of complaints of supposedly infinite and insurmountable difficulties involved in such research. This argument bears some truth, but it is not valid in the long run. An equivalent argument might have been handed to the caveman to discourage them from embarking upon their primitive and seemingly hopeless research, which must have ultimately led to our present technology. In other words, it is better to look back upon the successes of past programs if we need assurance for future efforts, regardless of the field. It is true that we are working with abstractions, but it is also true that even in abstractions, patterns have been discovered. These patterns, in turn, lead to either a better understanding of the phenomena involved or to new angles from which the phenomena can be studied. The sad evidence remains that such patterns have been discovered decades and centuries ago, but the material scientists, ever on the alert for things apparent, failed to see these apparent patterns. Such a pattern is expressed in ancient occult books with the words, as above, so below. This ancient allusion to the relation of the microcosm to the macrocosm is still missed by many physicists who are aware of the orbital systems of atoms and solar systems. Hypnosis was practiced by primitive humanity, but it has many centuries later that either the scientist or medical practitioner of our quasi-civilized society admitted the validity of the phenomenon of hypnosis. And it was probably a half century later after that admission that it was used as a therapeutic instrument as well as a parlor pastime. If it is possible for primitive peoples to come up with such an instrument long before Galileo demonstrated his lenses, he was belabored by the Church of Rome because he was unable to prove, as in a court of law, beyond all cavil and doubt, that the Pope was not the center of the universe, then there surely must be hope for the modern researcher. All the latter needs is the courage and basic intelligence of an Aboriginal shaman. We find another argument which claims that all occult phenomena are the result of fraudulent manipulations and that all transcendental cults result from the hunger of the needy layman and from the greed of the dispensers of nostrums and gimmicks. And I must admit that this argument has a true bearing on 90% of the cult movements, for if I did not recognize considerable and manifest fraudulence, I would have omitted much of this work. Yet even in some of the movements that have been proven to have fraudulent directors, we find some material borrowed from other sources which, in their own right, were not money motivated. And often, if we submit to dig through this type of redigested material, we will eventually come across evidence of historical research and note-taking, so that even the charlatan hacks of such evidence may have some value. Above all, no man should enter transcendental work with fear or expectations. He should attack it with the same energy he would apply to mastering calculus and with the knowledge or conviction that he can study either calculus or esoteric philosophy and still be a man. There is no reason for any man to anticipate any metamorphosis of his physical body or deterioration of his mental processes because of such a search. It is possible that preconceptions of an angelic development for men of the cloth and of saffron robes alike have resulted in their acting the part to a point of affectation of strange poses and states of mind. If we are male, we should advance upon the battlements of ignorance with the tools of the male, with aggressiveness. The female may find the mark better with passiveness. In any event, there is no danger of her becoming less feminine by being passive and less danger of losing her femininity. Both parties should never lose sight of human exigencies right up to the day of final victory or cosmic consciousness. Until that final day, our role can only be that of the fact man that is knowable. The curse of intellectualism. We are continually subjected to the fallacy that an intellectual is a wise man. Let us ask ourselves about the nature of our real objectives in pursuing the study that leads to being an intellectual. And then, after this self-scrutiny, let us ask our neighbor intellectuals, our colleagues, about their motives for becoming scholars or experts in an intellectual field. The human being goes into higher education because of primitive drives. The main factor in a young man's decision to fight his way through college is competition, to strive with greater facility for the material things of life, which is the same as saying he is putting a bit more effort into satisfying his physical senses, his appetites, or his fears. An engineer will have twice the earning potential of a shoe salesman and perhaps three times the earning ability of a farmer. With that proportion of earnings, he is better able to afford the type of fear or desire that might stimulate him. He does not specifically enter into the study of calculus to find the truth, and too often, once he has become a qualified engineer, he is apt to scorn anyone who overlooks his importance, or who might question the infallibility of science as the engineer sees it. In days gone by, there was a tremendous reverence for even a school teacher. Anyone who showed a love for learning was automatically presumed to be wise. A school teacher is little more than a memory bank for the community. They are the custodians of information. They memorize, but the nature of their work causes them to fall into the habit of acceptance of authority, which does not make for philosophers or thinkers. They drill and teach by rote, which has a hypnotic effect upon themselves as well as their students. The college student who takes up a more scientific course and avoids the teaching profession may well become an efficient slide rule or computer to enhance the environment or to aid the interminable scientific pursuits of society. But once the engineer has mastered the slide rule and become an extension of it, he has little time left to look into the nature of life and reality. The difference between the intellectual and the farmer, besides their earnings, is that the farmer sells his physical energy while the engineer sells his mind. And for this simple reason, the mind of the engineer is of less value to his capital S self, or to that part of him that depends upon the mind to evaluate itself. Go among your colleagues if you associate with intellectuals and ask them for the reasons for their pursuit of education, and ask them for their opinions about the scientific investigation of phenomenon as yet unexplained by our sciences, such as our approach by transcendentalism. Ask them to define themselves or to give reasons why they have not bothered to define themselves. You will find that nearly all intellectuals and scientists see no urgency in defining themselves before they define the material word about them. The appalling thing in the world of religion, and up or down to the world of psychology, is the manifest confusion. We have a painful weakness in regards to authority. Even the most absurd concepts will, by some twist of statistics or intuition, appear to be valid, and on the other hand, those concepts born out of reason or legalized by pseudo-authority will be constantly attacked by unexplained phenomenon or contrary evidence. Of course, the main weakness of both categories is that they are both mostly concepts rather than discoveries. Frustration besets us at every starting point and at every attempt at definition. We start off proclaiming nobly we are in search of the truth and are determined to find it. Immediately, there are authorities that will rise up and denounce us for fools, saying that the finite mind will never perceive the infinite. Yet the same theologians who utter this also attest to the teachings of Christ who advise us to seek in order to find, and who also declared that the truth would make us free. I am not at any point eager to ridicule the honest theologian, nor to belittle any effort toward genuine understanding. We may justly lament the fact that there are people who stand in the pulpit of authority whose only cause is their own, and whose words are geared to manifest their cleverness in argument, and whose arguments are oriented toward profit. These people are not always itinerant backwoods preachers or curbstone orators. Some of them have dictated the policy of major religions, and others have dominated entire nations. Which brings us to another facet of terrestrial thinking. We are inclined to think that that which everyone believes in must be true. We have carried our gregariousness over into a massive respect for mob opinion. Eminent theologians will proudly chant in tones acceptable that there is immortality because everyone believes it, while the truth that they hide is that everyone desires it. Of course, we are immediately open to confusion and even that criticism, because it is possible that everyone really believed in immortality. That belief might create some form of immortality, if it were not already otherwise a fact. However, we immediately come back to the factual statistics of the number of people who sincerely and unwaveringly believe that we will survive death. Many honest theologians feel that the only immortality hope lies in keeping the masses reassured so that their faith will be mountainous and creative to the point where the post-mortem status of their own particular religious group will be assured. I am inclined to believe that about 90% of the people desire immortality. There is a small percentage who do not even think about it, or who desire the eternal rest of oblivion. I doubt that a majority of the human race actually believes in the life after death. I think that even the zealot has a moment of uncertainty or light, whichever it might be, when he senses his own gullibility and gains a bit of insight into the complexities of his own rationalizations. I ask nearly everyone I meet to give me their beliefs on immortality and their reasons for thinking as they do. I am always looking for an account that will manifest conviction, and I am aware that perhaps I am seeking for some sort of magic that will give me a pattern of the truth that I have not previously contemplated. Regardless of motives, the answers that most people gave me, although possessing little of the magical or the illuminating, betrayed the trend of the thoughts and aspirations of the masses. It can be summed up best by the expression, "Me too." They do not presume to know that which is going to happen to them, and they do not presume to be big enough to find out. The layman points out that billions of people have gone on before him, and he expects to go to the same place with them. He might even remind me that he is paying his minister a salary to ensure his celestiality. If we approach the professional man or those who might be labeled the intelligentsia, we will obtain some really complex rationalizations or indications of very brave feudalism. The layman is often more honest than the well-educated man because he is conscious of his lack of learning. His intuitional doubts are equally as valuable as those of the pedant or philosopher. The layman is lazier because he allows another man to do his theorizing for him, but his laziness may also be intuitively inspired, since for some it is just as well to begin with frustration as to end with it, and it is human to clutch at straws. We are reminded of the force called Kal, which is a Radhaswami literature, is mentioned more frequently than the name of God, and I think that the one-sided amount of emphasis is appropriate. Kal is the force that keeps men in darkness, and when we start to recognize him, we see him all about us. God is not so apparent. I have always been conscious of the existence of opposition to spiritual growth, and I prefer to label this negative force as the forces of adversity. I prefer this label over such limited words as Kal or Satan. These items also imply personal opposition or the conspiracy of a particular being against humanity, and when all the evidence is in, we have no foundation for such a belief. In the search for reliable translations of the Bible, we find that Satan should really read as adversary. I am opposed to advocates of positive thinking, and by disciplines of the omnipotence of belief. I maintain that we are relative creatures. We have not yet merged with unity and lost our identity. We look at all things with two eyes, a bicameral brain, a mind that appraises with alternate logic and intuition, and we wallow in the misery of the paradox and the confusion of the polarity in our thinking. We attempt to utter our anguish message, and we find that we must use a relative language, and we are snowed under by heaps of words that can only express the difficulty of trying to say something accurately before we have lost the thought that fathered the effort. There are those who deny negative powers. Yet if man can conceive of positive powers, he must admit the negative. All is not sweetness and light unless somewhere there is bitterness and darkness. I cannot visualize a time when all will be wise simultaneously, for wisdom depends upon ignorance. Nor can I visualize an era when all men will share alike in a great economic brotherhood, because wealth depends upon poverty. If positive thinking means negating of negative forces, then I can concur. I cannot place my head in such optimistic sands that promise for my leaving my unfeathered rear exposed that no harm will come to me. Nature has a way of gleefully awakening the ostrich type. Those who have too great a faith seem to encounter disastrous opportunities to test that faith. One great Christian controversy centers around the despairing words of Christ upon the cross, since some feel that even Christ had a loss or weakening of faith. This type of positive thinking that has been offered to us as salutary in spiritual endeavors is better adapted to salesmen and persons who wish to free themselves psychologically from some mania or habit with the help of autosuggestion. Positive thinking does not bear the characteristics of a law, but rather identifies a technique or psychological lever. Cal is supposed to permeate all human thinking. Of course, this may leave us a bit confused, but when we first begin to read philosophically, we get a hint that much of the world in which we live is an illusion. Cal says that religions themselves were invented and diversified to dismay the sincere and persistent seekers. We have the biblical Tower of Babel. There is a story of a sort of Maya that resulted from the eating of a paradisical apple, the desire to be like God. These little legends seem to indicate that for a long time, man has had a whispering feeling that the game is fixed. We generally go through several stages of dismay that might be interpreted as education. We align ourselves with a religion or are aligned with one at birth. Then we notice discrepancies of dogma and the hypocrisy of the clergy. We become disgusted with yesterday's beliefs and we are attracted to another and opposite system of thinking. Then we find the second system equally as transparent as the first, and we increase our despair. But our attitude is broadened. We start looking for the good points of various movements, and from such optimistic endeavor plunge into a way of life that may reward us temporarily with a great feeling, one of bliss or illumination. However, it must be emphasized that such exaltation is temporary. We cannot understand this bliss, and when we try to analyze it or prolong it while living the vegetative life, it leaves us. And when it goes, we stand and wonder if we have not been the victim of self-hypnosis or hysteria of a sort, caused by the chemical changes in the blood or glands wrought by the spiritual practice engendered. And then, once again, we look over our shoulder to see if Cal is standing with his feet in our hip pockets, laughing. In the early stages of enlightenment, we look with pity on the old lady who takes her pennies to church for the padre to buy beer. We think we are smarter because we can analyze her blindness, or because we have been lucky enough to catch the pastor tippling, or overhear the preacher confessing to be only an oratorical emollient. Yet, while we are convinced that the cult to which we are paying tribute is beyond suspicion and often think ourselves fortunate to be picked by one that makes masters out of muttonheads, it will be good to pause and remember that it may be the same with the semi-exalted as with the lowly lady supplicant, as above, so below. It is often the case when a seeker is dismayed at the lack of truth in his native religion that he is very easily satisfied with a foreign creed that he understands even less. A new hypnosis is established, and the person who smugly thought he was above being hypnotized again is entranced. The Christian religion generally pictures a benevolent God who has scattered us like seeds, sung among the cockles and stones, and some on warm manure where we will prosper. In the Christian religion, we do not feel very important, so when we hear of a system of thinking that endows us with a godhead of sorts, we lift our ears readily. It is not the ignorant layman alone who is responsible for Oriental leanings. Some of our eminent lodges borrow from Indian literature and pass it on to their applicants as arcane knowledge. Many serious philosophers founded schools based on systems studied in the Orient. In sitting in the chair of the Western Hierophant, we again see Cal waving his wand and laughing. The lodges employ secrecy even as the Quadji Gurus of India. The secrecy is treasured with the same seal as the horseplay at the initiations. Those who decide to join an Indian cult may agree to an even more blind servitude to a teacher who speaks in a jargon more confusing than Latin. And while the candidate may have previously bought beer for one teacher, he will possibly now be buying hashish for another teacher. And after paying years of his life into a cult or lodge that promises everything in the line of secret revelations, he may discover that Freud was a greater revelator than any of his high priests. I have labored through some very dense writings in which the wisdom pretended therein was certainly circular, and like the symbolical serpent, managed to continually bite its own tail. And yet most of them stand abashed in the presence of a simple little story like the Bhagavad Gita or the Rubaiyat. We attempt to analyze the worth of a theory qualitatively and quantitatively, and in the process invent a storm of complex words, each bearing a dozen facets of meaning. Although the writers too must become confused, those abstruse scholarly writers on esoteric matters surely must enjoy the confusion that they know the reader undergoes in attempting to first understand them and then to seek the loose raveling that will enable the reader to pull the whole cloth apart. I think Cal invented all the big words and maybe is responsible for inventing all words. The inquirer goes out to seek understanding of these creeds or movements that promise immortality. He is often awed by the first books that he picks up or the first authority he meets on the subject. I wonder at this point how many people would have purchased a study of yoga and kindred subjects if certain words of the original Indian language were omitted and instead were replaced by simple synonymous English terms. For instance, let us take some of their words and place them alongside an English equivalent. We have a juvenile abhorrence of the word teacher, but we will climb the Himalayas in search of a guru. And by uttering the word guru, we manage to add another point of argument to our dictionary. Cultists talk glibly of Nirvana, Devachan, Brahmlok, and Satdesh as though the use of the words took them there magically. Heaven has lost its magical sound. Another term used which much abuse is the word chakra. Cult students will use the term with a glibness that would hint that they had actually seen one. If the word chakra means a nerve ganglion or gland, then we might as well call it that. On the other hand, if the word signifies a luminous focal point in the astral body, then of course we must presume that the speaker is quite sure of the mechanics of astral bodies, and we must be convinced that there is a body with such points. The cultist is hard to retrieve. He embarks upward on the path of cultism because of a disappointment with a conventional faith or because of a particular intuitive appeal from the cult's ism. He is taken in because the cult has a pretty composite blueprint that explains much that his old religion did not explain to him. Let us note here that explanation is not a system of proving. There are many concepts which are structurally symmetrical and congruous, but which bear no more value than a pretty picture. It is not enough to create a creed that fits together like a jigsaw puzzle. It must also try to prove its point and be beyond being simply desirable. Let us divest ourselves of the deluding dignity we assume at the instance of uttering a string of alien words. It only adds to our confusion and to the increment of the forces of adversity. Not only does a concept need to be structurally perfect to be acceptable, but it must be more all-inclusive and explanatory than any other concept. As long as there can be no philosophies that are proven beyond uncertainty, then we can only keep replacing new ones for old ones, and the new ones being those that by their propositions explain the most unexplained phenomena and satisfactorily answers the most questions. It is not enough to explain that the finite mind will never perceive the infinite. We must prove that the finite mind can or cannot ever be less finite. We must keep on looking. We know not where truth resides. There can be no paths to truth, only paths away from untruth. There is nothing proven for us in advance. We must experience for ourselves, and at best we can, begin with a working hypothesis. And we cannot spend too much time developing yardsticks to measure all the hypotheses for workability. We must find a yardstick that can be applied to all situations, and that yardstick must be very reliable. This book does not profess to solve the riddle, nor to be orderly in the presentation of a philosophy. I doubt that you could call it a philosophy, nor would I want it called that, because a philosophy, in attempting to be orderly and systematic, tries to build words upon words and syllogisms upon syllogisms. And I fear that such building involves sophistry. Being clever is commendable, perhaps for survival, but being clever for the sake of ego or for the entertainment of others will not help the cause of truth. And although I may try to get my point across with some skill or with an accent on humor, rest assured that my main motive is to hold the attention, not to entertain. I hold that these things which I say are those which I have come to believe, and that I consider any medium of expression inadequate to the serious compulsion I have to communicate them. In this careful attempt at honesty, there shall be no attempt to prove absolutely. And truth, with a small t, if it is to have a definition, would be that which is the most consistent and that which is the most inclusive of all human findings. For no matter how consistent our thinking may appear to us, as long as there remains a single phenomenon unexplained by it, or there remains another system in which there are no more flaws than our own, but which may have alternative or opposite claims to ours, then we must continue to search.